Hey listeners, this is a break from your regular listening on this channel. This is from my other channel, St. George's Riding Staff. It's a very important conversation, especially around Christmas, and a little gift to you. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to a special episode of the St. George's Ride and Staff, the official podcast of the Church of St. George the Martyr in Kaelsrug. It's been a while. We ended the podcast, but this is one of those conversations that we need to have because, and I'll read you an opening. Bethlehem occupied West Bank. Revered as the birthplace of Christ, the town of Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank is usually bustling with thousands of pilgrims and tourists in December. A giant Christmas tree, parades, and religious ceremonies typically inaugurate the season celebrations in Nativity Square. But this year, none of these things are happening because of Israel's continuing assault on the Gaza Strip and because of economic hardship. That is the opening paragraphs from an Al Jazeera story that was posted this morning. There will be no Christmas in Bethlehem. It's been 77 days since Israel started its bombardment of the Gaza Strip after, in retaliation to the October 7th massacre of Hamas on the Israelis in the surrounding areas around the Gaza Strip. Bethlehem is in the West Bank, Palestinian-owned West Bank, but in occupied territory of what's still happening there. It's been happening for generations. And I'm joined, as always, by my esteemed co-host, Father Reverend Rodney Whiteman. Hello, how are you doing, sir? And you engaged with faith communities, mixed faith communities this week, about trying to find some way to seek peace in Palestine.
Hi, Lindsay. Good to be back with you on this note. And also, hi to your listeners. Lindsay, I was invited by the Ahmadiyya a mosque community to participate in what they called a peace symposium. They've had this before, so it's a kind of a tradition with them. And I met the leader of the mosque, the teacher in their mosque, at a conference a meeting that we were hosting with Cape Crisis as the Western Cape Province Council of Churches, SACC, to address the taxi strikes that was happening in August and how it affected people, and also that we as church would make declaration, interfaith communities would make a declaration based on the preamble of the Freedom Charter. And it was there that I met him, and he comes from Pakistan, very peaceful and peace-loving man, and also the community members that I met on Thursday were indeed very accommodating. It's not on Thursday, on Wednesday, very deep and peaceable people. It was quite an engagement because I don't think I've been inside the main worship space of a mosque yet. And so we were asked to take off our shoes at a particular point because the space of their worship, when they go down on their knees and bow their heads onto the ground, it was that kind of spaces we had to respect. We were a cross-pollination of Jews for a free Palestine, so they were Jewish folk. They were various people from various Christian denominations, Catholic and others. They were also people from the emerging First Nation leadership in our Western Cape area, from the Khoisan clans, and there was a chief present who's taken in command. And, you know, these folk are quite dignified, but they are people of the struggle, and not just The meeting itself suggests that we, knowing what struggle we've been through in South Africa, also feel it when other people struggle against militarized and oppressive regimes. And so the talk was really around finding solutions. What can we do to find solutions for that crisis up in the Middle East?
Yeah.
But one of the things that kept coming back to us was, whilst we are trying to do that, and we must, we realize that here in our own country, and particularly in the Western Cape, we have gangsters fighting each other, people killed on a day-to-day basis, people being victimized. I was engaged with a cousin of mine who works in the Lavender Hill area.
Mm-hmm.
He's a chairperson of the Community Police Forum, and they are now brokering a ceasefire. Listen to the word ceasefire between two rival gangs. And isn't that the same word we were using recently and currently for the Israel and the Palestine? And it's not, this is where the confusion does come up. Is it Israel against Palestine, or is it the Hamas and Israel thing that has overspilled into, of course, the Palestinian? Be that as it may, I was shocked to hear the day before that 20,000 people have died in that skirmish at the moment. So what we had done there was, there were various speeches, and I was told by the, we were told by the chairperson that the quality of these speeches were quite a high nature, and they quite appreciated people. We had a person there who was a doctor lecturing in political science at the University of Cape Town, and he is from Turkey.
Yeah.
And he comes with a huge historical baggage. So one of the things about any incident that happens across the world and even in our own country is, what is the historical nature of this thing?
Mm.
And unless we understand that, we will choose the wrong side if we need to choose sides. And you know, Desmond Tutu, them always used to teach us, we are on the side of truth and justice.
Yeah.
And we are on the side as God is. I mean, Desmond had this statement, God has a bias for the sinner. God has a bias for the oppressed. And so, you know, we stand in that same corridor. Mm. And always something that triggers my interaction with people in these spaces is the fact that we are collectively seeking to address government theology, church theology, with prophetic theology. So we therefore needed a platform where, when people speak collectively, like one of the brothers, it's an 80-year-old man who is a Jew but an atheist, and he was an activist for the ANC. And Mervin is a very lovable person, but and very outspoken one, you can listen to with delight, as it were.
Yeah.
He had people die in the Holocaust. He said, the main issue for me, he said, is the rejection of Zionism in Israel and global Zionism. And then we were, you know, one of the things that I shared was, hands are clean of blood. No one. Perpetrators, their hands are dirty with blood because they penetrate with violence victimize people and kill them. Those of us that are seeking to save life and preserve it, our hands are also full of blood.
Mm.
But for what purpose? What does that represent?
Mm-hmm.
And the prophetic theology is about the preservation of life.
Yeah.
It's about calling people to the table to speak for peace, to negotiate peace, and to be peacemakers, and then to build something that is long lasting regarding how we will peacefully coexist with each other. And I mean, there's space enough for that. But there's no doubt, and it came out in that we are faced with the resistance of Israel to foster talks regarding a two-state solution.
Yeah,
Because
what we have
Israel
now is
doesn't
we have two groups of
want to
people
Yeah.
who cannot even entertain the idea of the other's right to exist. And
Yeah.
this is the intersection of Hamas and the Zionist movement,
Yeah.
where yeah, it's like Netanyahu has said in as many words that he wants to see the complete destruction. And I've been in conversation with Zionists who never want to engage about what's happening on the West Bank, who never want to engage. Then they shift the conversation to, but do you know where the Jews came from? And it's like, I don't care about where the Jews came from. Like, your religious beliefs is your personal choice. Like, I know where people came from, I know how people move, and people have the right to exist, you know, and to believe. But yeah, there seems to be no middle ground between these two warring factions.
And of course, the religious right wing exacerbates Christian Zionism. And that is also taken grounds here in South Africa, because those that are biblical fundamentalists read into that situation what they claim the Bible is saying. And even Jews are saying in the spaces that I have ventured in, they're saying the Israel that is currently there is not the Israel of the Bible, if one wants to have that argument. And so there's that kind of a confusion we must and it's quite easy to do that, because we in Old Testament we often read about Israel. It's the same sort of language that we read. So we want to make the connection as if it is that the same reality, and we've had to learn that it's not. So we're dealing then with something else here. We're dealing with, as somebody said, we're dealing here with what the British, and this person said it out out uitdrukkelijk, soos hulle sê in Afrikaans, that statement made in 57 or so in the British Parliament is the whole cause of the trouble we are sitting with now. 77 days have passed, but how many years has this been going on? How many generations have died, and how many generations still has to die before people realize this is not the way?
I came across an interesting conversation. Adam Conover is a comedian, and a media person in the United States, actor, screenwriter, all those things. And he has a YouTube channel called, I think it's Adam Ruins Everything or something like that. And he interviewed a journalist who's been living and working in Israel, crossing the border between Gaza and Israel. And he was saying that the October 7th attack, why the retaliation is so strong, it's because it was the greatest fear realized. So within the zone of Gaza, of the Gaza Strip, like in the attack zones, like those people have been living for like two generations in other people's houses, in displaced Palestinian homes. And they've always feared that one day the walls are going to come down and these people are going to come and take their land back and take their houses back. And then it happened. And it's very similar. Like, you can draw a straight line to the fear that happened around 1994, right? Like when Mandela was released, and when the ANC was unbanned, and how many white South Africans went into hiding and they were doomsday prepping because they believed that it was going to be the Nachfa Nilang Messe, you know? And then they were so surprised when it didn't happen. When life just kind of went on, when the oppressed just wanted freedom and not at the expense of anything else. And it's crazy that comes to this situation where I find myself holding in my head at the same time the idea that what happened on October 7th was horrible. It was reprehensible. But at the same time, it's kind of a long time coming.
You know, one wonders also, we are you a journalist, you in the field of producing information for the wider populace to be informed by. But of course, there's also journalism that doesn't tell everything, that chooses to let go of stories at certain points. And then invoke fear and all of that kind of stuff. I think one of the things that we haven't been hearing is, look, Israel is occupying Palestine. That's the one understanding I have.
In the West Bank, yes.
Hence Hamas, right? Secondly, and I mean they've been doing that for a long time. So what form does that occupation take? Now you have guys, of course, patrolling. They've got weapons on them. So it almost creates that fear within the local nationals. They then obviously are going to say, just how long are we going to have to live like this until some form of retaliation happens? Now, nobody wants to see Hamas's attack as a retaliation on having to live under that occupational fear. Because, I mean, I think, as somebody was saying, at some point we get, even if we don't have weapons, at some point we say, man, enough is enough. Of course, once we've said that, what are we then prepared to do? Because it could mean a loss of life or lives, as it has happened. So that's the risk you take when occupation happens, illegal occupation happens. And the only reason why they're doing that is because they just want to show Palestine, look, we really don't think you should be existing on the face of the earth. And yet, that land is Palestine. And now more and more around the whole, the some of the things that have come out in interactions I've had, and hence the Bethlehem thing, is that in the Gaza Strip, not only is there Bethlehem, but it's also the place considered to be where Jesus died on the cross. So that was what one person said to me. I haven't gone to check it out,
That
but
you're talking about the West Bank, so
West
Jerusalem,
Bank, yeah.
yeah, the Jerusalem's on the other side.
But it's all part of the Palestinian area. In
Yes.
other words, theologically, is Jesus a Palestinian?
Whoo. Oh gosh. Finish your thought.
And I know there are theologians that have actually mooted that. He may have been, he probably was, regarding the genealogies given to us in Luke and Matthew, his bloodline goes to David, and even to Abram in some cases. So one could consider him, but then the question would be, what is a Jew? Because I think this is where Mervin, my 88-year-old friend, would argue about this whole thing. Jew is Jew, because you see, well, this is Christian theology. Theologians have written and said the people who came out of Egypt, for example, were not homogeneously Jewish. They were a mixture of people who gathered at Shiloh as their first stop in going on to freedom. But now you get to this point, and when they get to make the cov God gets to make the covenant with them at Sinai, as the text tells us, was he talking there about a people who was whose bloodline was only this and not that? Or is it the fact that a whole mixture of people were gathering there and they were all together? So my question would be then, from the historical perspective, what's the name did? What I can never remember the name. what that guy did in the governmental courts of the UK of England in the 50s, declaring
the Balfour Declaration,
the Israeli state, that went totally against everything that was there. But I mean, look, Europeans loved creating false borders.
Yes.
Hence, we have the problems we have in the world today.
Mm.
So if you take it all together, you know, and we consider the space where some of my colleagues now went to today, they wanted to be a presence in a very volatile situation in the place that we, in the narrative, hear these angelic voices say to the shepherds, glory to God in the highest, peace on earth, and to all people, goodwill. What are we going to do with that message? Is that presence of peace that my colleagues are doing going to broker some peacefulness on both sides? The problem now with what you said is when you say Christmas is cancelled according to that report, is that on what authority was that done? Was that just Netanyahu's way of saying, we are on this bandwagon of genocide, and not even a holy festival is going to stop us from what we, or rather what he has planned to do?
Yeah.
Hence the cancellation of any form of celebration. To what did you say? 1 million? How many people go there at any given time?
In the year... I lost my notes now. But yeah, it's like 1.5 million people will go there, and they'll descend on Nativity Square. And I mean, you see every Christmas, you'll see on the news, there'll be broadcasts from there. And now it's like no one wants to go because of what's happening, because of the risks, because of the danger. But it's interesting what you were saying, because we were watching, I forget what it was. There's another like nativity kind of story that's doing the rounds now, the movie, and the thing that keeps repeating is that whole idea of no good thing comes from Nazareth. And it's a line that sticks with me because if you look at the map, and yes, I'm going to go there now. If you look at the historical maps, and you look at, like, Jerusalem was the center of Judea. So that was with the Romans, they set up there. And then, but David's Judea was centered in Bethlehem. And then they built, it was just the temple. So all the religious sites were in Jerusalem, but it wasn't like the actual administrative center. And it's insane when you look at that, then you're like, actually, because even if you look at like where Samaria was and where the Philistines were, which is basically the Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
With Palestinians. Yes. And like the biggest issue that I have is that even after the Balfour Agreement, when they partitioned Israel, obviously the other Arab nations, obviously they then rallied against it because they didn't recognize this as being like a country or being a people, legitimate thing. And then they had the war and then they lost ground. But if you are going to split a single country into two pieces on opposite sides of a piece of land, like how long, like that's, it's an untenable situation at some stage. And then it comes down to this whole idea of the violence, and I'm putting up my parentheses of the phrase from the river to the sea. And I understand that phrase as being a call to have a continued nation, a united nation from the Jordan River to the Red Sea.
It is.
And it, for me, it doesn't mean driving out the Jews. It doesn't mean that at all. And I think for the majority of Palestinians, it doesn't mean that. For Hamas, they want to eradicate all of it. That's in their constitution. Just like it's in the Zionist playbook that Israel is for Jews. So the two of them can't live together. But then you get like all these other things where there are still people alive that were displaced in the partition, in the Nakba. There are still all those memories that exist. There are still houses that Palestinians used to live in that Israelis are living in now, that Jewish Israelis are living in now. And when I equate it to what happened in South Africa, I can really internalize what the Palestinians must be feeling. And in that, I am so proud to be a citizen of a nation that has come through what we've come through and are now challenging the international community and saying, we stand for peace and a non-violent resolution to conflict. And we will try and bring that about wherever it occurs. And I really respect that.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I find very enlightening about this is that I've been in two meetings now engaging where there's been people from that are Jews. And besides Mervin and the people who are Jews for the peace of Palestine, there was also two other young women who were quite articulate about this. And they introduced us to what happens in a Jewish home, for example. There's a collection box where your money gets put into whatever is over, and that money is sent to the synagogues, and from the synagogues it is sent via their collective body in South Africa and across the world to Israel. And these women were saying that money, it's called the blue box, that money is utilized to support the war of Israel against Palestine. And they were totally disgusted with the fact that their rabbis were not willing to speak out about this. Now, I do understand too that people are reluctant to associate Israel as an apartheid state.
Yeah.
And yet the evidence is there, as you say. We can see the correlations with our own experiences. That is happening. So there's no doubt in our minds we identify with the oppressed who happens to be the Palestinians. There is possibility that though there are people in Israel right now, Jews, who are not for this war, and I don't know how outspoken they may be, but it was quite interesting that the slogan from the river to the sea, which ends off with Palestine shall be free, had become such a statement that people were so resistant against, because the understanding, as you earlier muted us, that if Palestine is free, that means there'll be no Israel. So it's an obliteration of the Israel nation. But there's an understanding which came from a Palestinian that said, from the river to the sea, all must be free. And of course, I struggle with the word must as well as all will be free. Yeah. So you choose which one do you go to. But now, how can such a slogan be offensive? Isn't that the kind of slogan we should be having that draws us to the table? Because at the end of the day, do we really want to have a history where 20,000 people are recorded to have died? Defenseless people. And then in our meeting the other day, The chief of the Khoisan, one of the Khoisan groups, had said his 5-year-old daughter, when Shina knows the pattern before he takes her to the school, she switches on the TV and there's Al Jazeera and she says to him, "Dad, there's your news program." And at that time, she was alone there, he hadn't come through yet, when she saw how children were killed by the Israeli. And she was crying, and a dad came in and said, "What's going on?" She said, "Why do they kill children?" Now, if you can traumatize a 5-year-old in another place, how much must it be for children living in that spaces? So you and I can really identify, although, they didn't bomb us as Israel is bombing Palestine now and so on, but we lived at on the fear of death every living day as a Palestinian. And of course, we were also occupied. These guys were walking through our communities, and we were literally in prison. So how could we not have a presence in Bethlehem at this time? So thank God for people like Frank and Michael and others that are there on our behalf, because we carry the same experience. But we do not come as guerrilla fighters. We do not, as on the other side, people from our own country are now wanting to join Israel's army. There's a controversy around that. We are not going there to fight. We're going there to say there is only one way of coexistence, and that is we must get to the table of peace.
No, I really those people have my utmost respect, to fly the values of South Africa, the values that this country post 1994 has been founded on, to hold up our constitution and say that this is a model for the world to follow. But that said, let's turn to the conversation about the liturgy. So Jesus came as a symbol in a time where there was a lot of oppression, and it was oppression, and it had like many layers to it. So it was the Roman occupation of Israel. Then it was the community leaders that they had propped up, that they had put in place, the Sanhedrin and that, and how they infiltrated the religion and used that as a tool of suppression and oppression. And then below that, so each person just wants to crap on the person below. So they always want someone lower than them. So the Sanhedrin had like everybody else, and then everybody else had like the shepherds, and the shepherds had, so there was always like somebody that you could say, they are different from me and I am better than them. And that's what it comes down to. That's what all these oppressive systems are built on, is that idea that one is greater than the other. One has more right to exist. And then in comes this symbol, born in a manger, all those things, had the foreigners coming through, giving great gifts, had the shepherds there, were the first people to be heralded by the thing is that basically a Palestinian father who had descended from this royal line but had no agency through his royalty, the supposed royalty, because surely if you were descended directly from David and like your family was known as this, if you rolled up into Bethlehem and wanted a room at an inn, they would have given it to you, not so? So you have all of this, and then in comes this baby gets born, and this whole thing gets started. And now there are people who believe this, who have internalized this nativity story as the genesis of their religion, of their beliefs, of their foundational humanity. Because people tie their humanity to their spiritual beliefs. And then in the same breath, they can, as you said, go want to enlist in a Zionist army to oppress the Palestinians. Do people not read? Do people not understand what the symbols mean that they venerate at this time of year?
You know, part of the problem with what I seem to engage is that the book that holds the narrative is both dangerous in the hands of people whose fear is so huge and their fundamentalism is governed by their fear, that when they read a narrative, they read into their fear. They don't let the narrative speak to their fear. I was saying to somebody yesterday, I said, you know, the Bible, people worship the Bible. I don't believe that they actually worship the God of the Bible. So the Bible points us to him, and so we enjoy the narrative because it makes a connection with him. We listen and we question why was that allowed? And sometimes we don't get ready answers, particularly when we read of suffering, when we listen to a narrative where people rejoice because God had intervened and beat up whoever their enemies were. I sometimes think those stories are deliberate to say, is this really God's way? But of course we people read into it from a fundamentalistic point of view. And they worship the Bible as inerrant. Hence, we have the propaganda that goes on. When the ultimate story, I mean, Karl Barth was a revered scholar of theology. And Karl Barth was asked by a student, what does Karl believe is the fundamental message of the scriptures? And he said it in his own language, but it was interpreted in English as a hymn that we sing with children. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. What's the imperative? That he loves me. Where do I find the narrative? In the scriptures. And so the narrative connects us to the person of who Jesus is. And so the question then would be, what I tend to find, and you've mentioned all of these other folk, the Sanhedrin and all of those kind of things. In the gospel narratives, they were the ones that were the mo in most opposition to Jesus, right? And accused him of being a devil in a particular passage. He then said these words to them, you know neither the power of God nor the word of God. Now, can you tell a scholar of the Torah, he doesn't really know that word. So what was Jesus trying to tell us about? How should we know the word of God? And I think people have fallen into a trap. There's this fear in America that's expounded by some of the people who are in the evangelical of what they call replacement theory, that the church doesn't replace Israel. So they fundamentalistically hold on to the Israel that is there now and associated with the Israel of the Bible. That has corrupted many a Christian message, if we believe in that way of theologizing. And so here, what is even more devastating, well, that's not true, but what is obviously devastating is when a false narrative goes out. And people believe it and therefore act on it. So that same people that believe in Jesus, the symbol of God's peace for the world, who would teach us the way of peace, now believes also that Israel currently is the Israel of the Bible. So based on that, I must go and fight for Israel and with Israel, instead of saying, what did Jesus come for? Who did he come for? What was he about? And was his presence in the world not meant for us to embrace peace across every boundary, and that we share a common humanity with everybody? And as you said earlier, very interesting, you said people's beliefs inform their humanity. And then one needs to say, if your humanity is exclusive, then how can your belief be correct? If Jesus' baptism and his birth is an association with solidarity for all human beings, then whatever the humanity of Jesus is, was informed by his divinity and vice versa. Why are we not in that space? Why is our humanity associated on degrees? If you Israel, you are top of the pops.
Yeah.
But if you Palestinian, your value has dropped. Yet it was where that Jesus' family had to go, because that fake King Herod, who felt threatened by the presence of a baby, and Jesus goes to with his family to Egypt.
Yeah.
He becomes a refugee. And so with who was he associating with now? When his own people, with their false king and their bad interpretation of scripture, excommunicated him from their country, he fled for his life. And he comes and he associates. He doesn't go to another country starting a war. He goes to seek refuge, and he's granted it. But he comes back into that space of violence. That same king beheads John the Baptist for speaking the truth. And of course, these are the things we learn in political science now, don't we?
Yeah.
When you speak truth to power. So it would seem as if, in the mold of Jesus, we also have to stand up, but it's going to be costly. I mean, we must pray for the safety of our brothers and sisters who've gone on our behalf to Bethlehem. But then they went, and hopefully they'll come back safely. But the very people of Palestine will have to live with that threat of bombing every living day. In that space, Jesus was born. That space he came. In that space, his life was threatened. So why would we join an army that wants to destroy, rather than be a vulnerable baby, defenseless as is? That vulnerability must speak volumes, and does, if we but embrace it. I have recently said that for me, the wood of the cradle became the wood of the cross. For what he believed, he died for. But he died as he was asked to live and be born, for peace, not for violence, for reconciliation, not to divide people, to ensure forgiveness, not to hold vengeance. To equalize the playing grounds for all people, rather than the systems that we have in the world, both political and, unfortunately, in religion. One of the things that the Ahmadiyyan leader taught me, he said, I often reach out to the other mosques that are in our areas. They treat us as pariah. They say we are sectarians. They would not want to associate. All that we are wanting to do is to be those who will help broker peace amongst all people. Not wanting you to believe in the same way we believe, but we do know that you will embrace the concept of peace, the value of peace. You may do it from your belief system, but it's still peace we're talking about. So why don't we get there? On the back of the business card of the person that is that is part of the Jews for a free Palestine, is the words of Desmond Tutu, where he says, we must not seek to celebrate our differences, but we must seek to find commonalities and common ground so that we can live peaceably together. I thought that was a very important quote. But now the question I have, why is it that some people choose not to believe? Why do they will not embrace the symbol of peace? Why has the gun and violence? Because one journalist from Israel said on a YouTube, one of the things that Israel is doing right now is testing out new weapons that have been given to them.
Yeah.
Now, can you believe if that is true? Can you believe it's for me very, very frustrating. In that space, a child was born associated with peace. A human just filled with hatred, enmity, fear. Is that what governs us? Revenge eventually? Yeah. And why would we choose for that to embody our minds and our spirits rather than that which gives for peace?
Because it's easier to fight an other than it is to embrace everybody.
But in fighting the other, are we not really fighting with ourselves?
Yes. Yes. It's that idea, that philosophical idea of like your humanity is tied to everyone else's. So if you start eliminating others, you lose yourself.
Absolutely. Now, if there are religious beliefs that do not embrace that reality, then why are people still espousing to them?
Because that's what they know. That's how it's been taught. That's how your colleagues have gone about delivering the message, where the message is, it's about the feeling. It's about the vibe.
Sure.
Because people want to feel that fire. And unfortunately, that fire comes from... I was telling my daughter the other day, I had a issue with a colleague. I was asked to take a story down that I had worked very hard on, and it was part of a series, and I had lined up a whole bunch of other things, but it wasn't in this person's head. It wasn't... it didn't suit the platform. And I took offense to that. And I then was on this mission to just kill them with excellence and produce stories. And then I was telling my daughter that I was writing in anger, and I, even though it's entertaining and it feels good, and I sometimes produce some of my best work, it's a very negative space that I don't like to inhabit.
Yeah. But there is a form of righteous anger that we can't ignore.
Mm.
Particularly when people assume that their way of thinking is the best way and they force that on there. Maybe they've got a position in order to do that.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, like Desmond says, where are the common grounds in our debates? Then we can make a common decision going forward. Now, this is what this peace symposium wants to do.
Mm.
It's a peace symposium gathering people of all walks of life at great risk, fundamentally. And they seek to build friendships,
mm.
not to change the way I think, but to base itself on the sense of peace that we need, that in fact, is purported to have been in all religions,
yeah.
they would say. Well, then, why is it then where fundamentalists are so eager to be scapegoating and donor everyone that doesn't agree with them?
I see it a lot when people interact with me, where I'm an agnostic, and I like one of my fundamental beliefs is that Jesus was not the Son of God. Because there may not be a God. Like that's where I start from, is that I'm a human first and everything else is secondary to that. And I try and interact with the world. But then people will hear something like that, and then they will come and try and change my mind to be part of their tribe. And it's like, you don't need everybody to believe the same thing that you do. Like, do you understand that? That there are billions of people on this planet, and not everybody believes in God, in the same God that you do, and they continue their lives in complete happiness. So it's that whole thing of like, if you're going to pray for somebody, like, do it in your own time. Like, don't tell them that you're praying for them, and don't make the end goal that you're trying to, like, save them. You know, like, I'm not killing anybody. I can still be a good person without the idea of Christian religion, you know.
When one looks at the group of people that Jesus associated himself with, according to the gospel narratives, not all of them were straight thinkers in the way Jesus was, and he was teaching them. They challenged them, and their attitudes and their behavior sometimes was questioned by him, you know, because there was this passage in Mark chapter 10, I think it is, when he says something like, the Son of Man came not to serve, but to be, not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And just earlier, and he said, we are not like that. So the kings of the world do it this way. We choose not to do it this way. And he associated himself with service and giving of his life to save others. So that's an important teaching that we need to embrace. And he didn't coin it, he didn't say, gave his life as a ransom only for Israel.
Yeah.
You know, he said, gave his life as a ransom inclusively. So how do we do that? I mean, isn't that what these people are doing in Bethlehem now? To side with the oppressed, they're risking their own lives, hoping that that presence there may just say to the aggressive army, you can't be killing people from another country who hasn't come with weapons, but who's come with the message of peace. So we are in a struggle where if somebody, like with Mervyn stood up and Mervyn said, I'm an atheist. I'm a Jew, but I'm an atheist. He says, but it angers me that the oldest Roman Catholic church in Palestine was destroyed by IDF. The oldest mosque was destroyed by IDF. He said, that just makes me angry that somebody's faith symbolisms are just obliterated like that. And he says, but I am an atheist, but I believe firmly that if others believe in that way, they must be respected. And so why go to that extent? Of course, you then hear how people who perpetrate violence and are caught out, now they give explanations of justification. And always they pass the buck to someone else as if they were not the ones that did it. So again, you know, in your and my work, where we have to speak, where we have to collate a message, where we have to think of what we're supposed to say, because our message is, number one, to speak the truth into the situation after we researched what was going on there. We use different narratives to be able to speak from. We use scripture, for example. We use tradition. We also consult history. And all of those things are important around how the message of the gospel is proclaimed.
Yeah.
It's not just the raw message that we've just discovered and we speak, and then we speak empty words. Because even just saying peace is an empty word if there's no peacemaking, you know, if there's no peaceful attitude. And we are caught up in a plethora of voices. And people must search, we must each search our own hearts to ask and our own minds to ask, why do I respond to that message with all that it conjures up and then makes me want to act in a particular kind of way And why do I not respond to that message? For example, why are some Christians buying into Zionism when others of us are saying, hold it, Jesus came for the peace of the whole world. We can't allow one group of people to obliterate another people, what's his name, by the way that they're doing it. We must speak up and speak out. It may come at cost, but we can't avoid talking out. The only weapon we have is to understand the truth and to speak the words of justice and peace into a situation, calling for reconciliation. This is the work we are supposed to be about, but it will come at great cost. So why are people so easily influenced? I mean, for how many years have we in South Africa, amongst the Christian churches, also been anti-Muslim because of the propaganda we believed in? You know, it's not as if people are going to destroy our faith. The only person that's going to destroy your faith is you yourself.
Indeed. Indeed. And like for me, like that's the most frustrating thing about the whole situation is there's people that I respect who have Jewish roots who are now taking a hard stance against Hamas as a symbol of anti-Semitism. And
Okay.
I'm sorry, but I'm getting tired of predominantly white people telling me what racism feels like.
There's something interesting.
Yeah, but you were saying something interesting earlier about like the destruction of the church of the mosque in Gaza. And I was thinking about it and I was like, is it because of a latent grief for the destruction of the temple, of the temples?
Wow, that is a powerful window to look at what would be in the minds of those who would lament, weep about the destruction of the temple.
I mean, they literally have a wailing wall
Yes,
where they go
absolutely.
and lament and weep.
Yes, but I would have hoped that the wailing wall was more than just weeping for a building that was destroyed. It is weeping for the lack of peacefulness in my heart and in the way that I'm building a peaceful community or not. That would be for me a purpose of a wailing wall that all of us could actually come to. It could be a place for reconciliation, not a place to conjure up ideas to destroy another person's symbol of faith, simply because, you know, it is interesting. It's interesting how, in our own narrative in South Africa, how generous the oppressed has been towards the oppressor and people who benefited from oppression of others. Those same people do not want us to recall that history. You know, so it's and that is probably what the powerful often do. They want to see themselves as victim rather than as one who needs to seriously repent, who seriously needs to. They are still in the past, as far as I'm concerned, because they still hold the narrative of their past. Only now we cannot tell them, but you were part of the oppressor, you know. So that is why it's very interesting that, generally, in my view, white folk are supportive of Israel. And in many ways, there's a sector of the churches in our country who are often the creation of white men and people follow them, and they're very much supported by the religious right wing of South of America, who would be supportive of this Israel current existence, which causes a split in the churches, you know. And so in the platform of us speaking collectively against what is happening in the Gaza Strip, you would often find us warring with each other, as happened not so long ago. There was 30,000 a peaceful march. One of our colleagues represented us at that. The next day, there was a different kind of march with a different kind of spirit. It was more destructive than it was peaceful. So one needs to measure and say, who is then for peace?
I don't know, but we it pains me when South Africans are having a go at each other over these things. And they reduce it to a petty ideological argument when the actual horror that's happening is at such a scale that it dwarfs any idea of this being a religious skirmish, you know. And it's not about because you are one religion, you automatically have to, you know, who's on the side of people? And
That is what, sorry.
no, it was, I was just saying, like we need to guard against it causing further rifts within our South African reality, within our society.
That is why M Mervin is clear. He said, what is anti-Semitic is Zionism in Israel and Zionism internationally. You know, and so when we do speak against what Israel is doing, it's not anti-Semitic.
No, it's not. It's not because Islam is also a Semitic religion.
You know, and of course, it is unfortunately so intermingled. You have people talking about the Middle East. You hear them talk about the Abrahamic faiths. So that element is in there. And then you have political rhetoric. That's a, you know, Israel is a state. Palestine is not. And the people who have created that are sitting with their hands folded and wanting to do not, have nothing to do with it, or perhaps supporting it in ways we don't know. Because look, undergirding all of this, we do not even know what's the underground of all of this. Who is giving weapons? Oh, we do know a little bit of that. Who stokes these things to create that kind of what's? I mean, I remember that in the year 2000, there was this whole hype about it being the end of time, and you know, millennialism has come, and this will be the final battle of Armageddon. Right? There were American fundamentalists who had gone to Israel that had said, "We are here to ensure that this war begins. If nothing happens, we are going to create the war." And their firm belief was that in creating the war, that this would be the time when Jesus would come back to earth again. The Battle of Armageddon would happen. And it's an us and them battle. We are for God, the others are not. So obviously, we must be the army of the Lord here on earth. And so they believed that. That was a fundamentalist persuasion. You see, and people buy into that, unfortunately. You know, thank God it didn't happen. But who knows, was this what people thought is what they want to do. So who's behind all of this from wherever sides? We just don't know. I don't know what you journalists do in trying to uncover all of those things, but I mean, I can understand how dangerous it must be to get the truth out there as to what is really happening on the forefront, but also behind the scenes, and who is who in all of this.
No, that is quite crazy. And just in conclusion, where these stories really go is, so Monique's been reading the Gospel of Luke now throughout Advent. And I think it was Luke chapter 21, where Jesus speaks of the end times, where it will be brother against brother and all those sorts of things. And I just walked into it last night, and there was a discussion with my family about it maybe referring to now. And I'm very twitchy when it comes to those kinds of prophetic things, because I believe in chaos. I believe in chaos theory, where there's no rhyme or reason to anything, but there are forces that are instigating things. And if you And this has always been my single criticism of the Bible and how it's been edited, is that if you are looking for the intertextual links, you will find them. And if you were psychotic enough to create a situation that resembles a passage like that, you could. And because so many people are familiar with the stories, and so many people are longing for a prophecy, they are longing for a second coming, they are longing for a Messiah, if they see the signs that look the same, correlation will mean causation for them, and that is very dangerous. And I just wanted to know if you have any, and I'm going to use the flowery language of your people, if you have any words on your heart that you would like to share, just in closing, as we go into to Christmas.
I think I want to just, in response to what you say around Monique's journey with Luke, is that she's reading through Luke, which means that when she gets to passages of that nature, it must be read in the context of the whole book. Now, did Jesus say it will happen because he understood how human people think, how we operate, how we function? That was, as it were, a warning to perhaps think ahead and say, should we go that route, or would Jesus have a different way of dealing with this? Because look, conflict, as you say, happens in families all the time. But do we necessarily say that's the end time? Now, your what's his name said something to me about the liturgy. You started off with that words, the liturgy. And it is in the context of the breaking of the bread and the spilling out of the wine that we say, and so we proclaim the mystery of faith. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. Now, who is this Christ that will come again, that we are celebrating his coming again? Well, he came, Christ has died, associates itself with a breaking of the bread and a spilling of a wine. The wine is often associated with new covenant, a new way of living in relationship with God and with each other. So in preparation for his continuous coming, because in the beginning of our liturgy we say, the Lord be with you, God is here, His Spirit is with us. We also are saying that according to His teachings, there will be a coming again. How that form of shape will take, we don't just know. Jesus Himself was asked those questions, and He said, neither the Son knows, only the Father knows. Jesus said to the disciples in the book of in the Acts of the Apostles, you know, it's not for you to know. Get on with spreading good news. So for me, did He say those words in such a way that it would create? Now we must be, that's going to be the signs. Because why are we looking for these signs when He says, do this in remembrance of me? What are we meant to do in remembrance of Him when we break bread and we say we are many, are one body?
Yeah,
that's symbolic, but it, do it in remembrance of Him. What are we supposed to do in terms of being a body? I did a devotion yesterday which spoke about drawing closer to others, creating community. So what was that bread all about? When the spilling of the blood, and I say those words intentionally. You know, we talk about drink, but I'm talking about spilling. Because I simply believe that when that blood dropped to the ground out of which Adam was formed, it was to redeem the Adama that is always in conflict, always in vengeance seeking and blaming. So it was to wash us clean and get us back to our original self, as it were, the first Adam, if one would say it like that. I had a counselor that always used to say to me, Rodney, when he has listened to some of the struggles I was sharing with him, he says, that's the problem with the first Adam. It's still with us. Second Adam is redemptive. So I think that if we say it is those, and He will come again in the context of the Eucharist, we need to ask ourselves, in what meaning do we do that in? When He in fact says, in remembrance of me, do this, do what in remembrance of me?
Yeah.
And Paul has a beautiful line that I love. He says, when we're doing communion, this is a proclamation of the death of our Lord until He comes again. So what does that death mean? And how is it symbolized in the breaking of the bread and the spilling of the cup?
Yeah.
When we are divided and we don't share the same loaf, we see a loaf as the food of the poor. And we don't want to share the food of the poor. The person whose blood is spilt, we do not want to associate ourselves with persons who are victimized because we want to be the powerful. So how then are we really preparing for His coming again when we're not even doing that which is in remembrance of Him who brought unity and who brought redemption and forgiveness?
Mm-hmm.
So by saying Jesus said those words, was it necessarily Him saying, okay, so that's going to happen, you must just wait till it happens? No. Was He saying that because He knew that is the way we are? And He was trying to get us to rethink how this will be. I mean, are we associating His coming again just with disaster?
And I think on that note, we will sign off. Thank you very much for this conversation. It has been greatly enlightening, and It was a return to form. It was a return to thought, to deep reflection on things. Because yeah, I've never actually thought about that thought of, are they destroying these things because they're still grieving the loss of the temple? Yeah, that was an original thought that popped into my head in that moment, and I'm glad I could share it with you. And thank you,
Thank you.
and happy Christmas.